me talk already. I promise I tried to space some things out so we're not covering the same exact material over and over. But all right, so jumping to the case. So today I'm going to talk about just briefly pertussis background and then go into the bulk of what we saw in 2010 during the epidemic. I'm going to talk about some of the challenges that we faced and some of the successes that we think we accomplished, and then our ongoing efforts. Pertussis has been called one of the most poorly controlled vaccine-preventable diseases, and I think we've demonstrated that this year. Incidence has been increasing since the 1990s, and we know about the cyclical peaks. And pertussis is very contagious. The basic reproduction number estimate is somewhere between 12 and 17. So that means any single case of pertussis, if surrounded by completely susceptible people, can infect up to 12 to 17 additional people. And estimates show that approximately 80% of susceptible household contacts become infected. The minimum proportion of the population that must be immune to eliminate transmission of pertussis is estimated to be about 92 to 95%. We know that adults are vulnerable to pertussis, and studies have shown that about 25% of reported cases are among adults, and that about 20% of cough illness lasting more than 2 weeks among adults is actually pertussis. We know that immunity wanes somewhere between 4 and 12 years after the DTaP series and between 4 and 20 years after having natural infection. Tdap was licensed in 2005, but uptake has been suboptimal, and national estimates show uptake among adults around 6%. And adults tend to have atypical pertussis. They don't necessarily have the classic whoop, and they don't always have the paroxysms of coughing. Often we hear that adults report feeling like they're choking or having these sweating episodes, so they may not have classic disease. So why has it been increasing from the 90s? Well, I think we've already heard a few theories on that. There's been questions about whether or not there's greater virulence in genetic changes, and that hasn't fully been answered. There's questions about vaccine efficacy, and a number of studies have been showing that efficacy remains good, and it's around 85%. We know that waning of immunity exists, but I think a big part of it is that we have better available laboratory tests to detect pertussis, and we have better general awareness among clinicians. So we've seen this graph on the national level. This is just California, going back from the early days of reporting. You can see where DTP was widely used in the 40s, and then when acellular DTaP was licensed and was first used for the latter two booster doses, and then eventually in the late 90s was used for the full series. You also can see when PCR became available, and that possibly corresponds with some of the increases that we've seen. So in California, we were defining cases of pertussis the same as we do for confirmed and probable with the CSTE definition. But in the midst of our outbreak, we simply could not keep a case open for investigation long enough to determine if they always met the clinical case definition. So often what would happen is a single case would get reported, the public health investigator would go in, do whatever measures were needed for public health, find out who in the household was coughing, what their symptoms were, who had been tested, and then that was the information we got. We could not keep the cases open to follow up 2 weeks or 3 weeks later to see who was still coughing. So we had a lot of cases that we considered suspect cases, and we defined that as a person that had an acute cough illness that was PCR positive, or that had an acute cough illness and had paroxysms or whoop or post-tussive vomiting who was epi-linked to a lab-confirmed case. So you can see our breakdown. Around 60% were considered confirmed, 18% probable, and around 20% were suspect. And again, we don't know if all those suspect cases would have met the clinical case definition or not. We just simply couldn't manage the surveillance side. So we've seen this graph a few times, and our number has been bouncing around somewhere between 9,300 and 9,400 for 2010, and our data are still provisional, so it'll be somewhere right around there when it's finalized. But we've seen more cases this year than we have since 1947, and our incidence is around 24 per 100,000. And it's striking. Certainly you can see how the incidence is not quite as high as it was back in 1947 just because of the population changes. And here's our epidemic curve. The bulk of cases were occurring in June and July and August, but you can see that they've lingered, and we've still continued to have a large number of cases reported through the end of the year. And this graph actually goes through February, and we're seeing still the same number of cases reported in January and February will come up when we get full data that we saw back in 2005 during the peak months. So we are still seeing a lot of activity. We've had over 500 cases reported so far occurring in 2011. So I mentioned earlier that the bulk of cases are being now reported and being confirmed by PCR, and this graph shows that nicely. So the blue bars are showing the number of cases that have been confirmed by culture starting back at 1990. And you can see in 2010, culture is still a factor. It still is being used. In California, it's mostly being done in hospital settings and not often done in the outpatient setting. And you can see with the blue line, this is the percent of cases that are confirmed by culture. But then the red bar shows PCR, and it's just really impressive how many cases are now being confirmed by PCR alone, and it's over 60% of our cases in California. This graph is data that we received from Southern California Kaiser, which is a large HMO. There's a Northern California and Southern California Kaiser in California. And the bars are showing the number of tests that were done to run for pertussis, the number of PCR assays. And then the blue line is showing the proportion of those cases that were positive for pertussis. So I think what's interesting here is that, you know, the number obviously went up of case people actually being tested during the peak weeks. But it's remained fairly steady throughout. And early on in the epidemic when we had, during the peak weeks, we had the highest proportion of cases that were positive. But that number's actually remained fairly steady as we go towards the end of the year. So even though activity has slowed, it's still around the same amount that we've been seeing for the last several months. So overall rates have been highest in infants less than 6 months of age, and among those have been highest among Hispanic infants. And if you can see this green bar, this is 541 cases per 100,000, so 5 cases per 1,000 among Hispanic infants born in California. But you can see the Hispanic overrepresentation actually disappears as you get into the older children and adults. And the overall rates are highest in Hispanics, but it's entirely being driven by these infants less than 6 months of age. And you can see rates among whites around 20 per 100,000, but among Asians and blacks, rates are lower than they are in whites and Hispanics. And then we see this rates starting to go up for the 7 to 9 and 10 to 18-year-olds, and we saw that in the national trends as well. And this graph shows that a little more obviously. This is infants less than 1 year of age, and then we see by year, by age. And this the line includes all race ethnicities, but then each one is broken out. And you can see, the Hispanic overrepresentation here, but that it reverses, and whites are actually overrepresented amongst adolescents. And this is showing children less or infants less than 1 year of age. Again, you can see the Hispanic overrepresentation. And you can see as every dose of DTaP is administered, incidence declines dramatically. And I think this is the most compelling graph to show that the vaccine is effective and it does work to prevent infants from getting infected. I think what's interesting to point out on this graph, too, is the bulk of infants that are being infected are really being infected somewhere between 1 and 4 months of age. And so that really is suggestive with cocooning, because if those infants, the source of their infection is somebody who may not have been infected when the baby was born. So if you protected the mother right during the immediate postpartum period, she may not become infected. So, you know, that you're always looking for the source case for the infant, and it might not be somebody who was already coughing. It might be somebody who got infected after the baby was born. So that's a good argument to support cocooning. So far, our data are not complete yet for 2010, but we have over 660 hospitalized cases. And most of those were infants that were less than 6 months of age, as we always see in the national trend, and most of those were less than 3 months of age. And about 50% of all of the infant cases we know of that were less than 3 months of age were hospitalized. The majority of our hospitalized cases were Hispanic, and that follows the overrepresentation that we saw. And many had other co-infections that were identified, such as RSV or influenza, and this can confuse the diagnosis or delay the diagnosis if something else is identified or if the symptoms are not entirely classic for pertussis. Unfortunately, we had 10 deaths in 2010. 9 were Hispanic infants and 1 was white. And the overall case fatality rate among infants less than 3 months of age was 1.4%. All but 1 were less than 2 months of age and had not received any doses of vaccine. And then there was 1 death that occurred in a former preemie that was 2 months and had received just 1 dose of DTaP. And what was most concerning is that we saw a trend with a lot of our fatal cases. Many had household contacts at home that were coughing, siblings or parents, and no one had suspected pertussis or talked to those families about getting vaccinated. And many of the infants had been taken into providers multiple times, and nobody suspected pertussis early on. We had one of the fatal cases that the mother had brought in to see 5 different providers in 1 week, and pertussis was only suspected in the very last visit. Overall, our trend for the pertussis deaths have been in infants less than 3 months of age in California, and 80% have been Hispanic, so this is not something new for us. All of those that have had known clinical picture all had pneumonia and pulmonary hypertension, and they all have had a leukocytosis with a mean white blood cell count of over 75,000. And there's theories that the leukocyte mass can actually diminish the blood flow in increasing vascular resistance. So some experts are now recommending doing an exchange transfusion as part of treatment to help possibly reduce the pertussis toxin. So this is a similar graph to what we showed earlier, but this is broken down by vaccination history. You can see the different ages where the doses are administered. And the purple bars at the bottom represent people that had no doses of vaccine. So we've gotten a question a lot about how people who are unvaccinated are playing into this epidemic that we saw. And certainly there's a component there of unvaccinated persons because we know that they are susceptible to disease. But most of our cases had been vaccinated. Not all were up to date on vaccine, but many had received at least 1 or more doses of vaccine. And you can see here, as going up, those that are yellow here are considered up to date, and then those who have the green have been given Tdap. So we have seen a few cases among people who were recently administered Tdap. So the big question is, why are so many of our cases vaccinated? And this is just a kind of a brief illustration of why that is, looking at what we know about vaccine efficacy estimates. So if we had, theoretically, 100 adolescents who had just been administered Tdap, and of those, about 53% would have accepted it because that's what our coverage estimates are. And but of those, only about 66%, if using efficacy estimates of 66%, some of those vaccinated people would still be susceptible. And then, of course, we have those who weren't vaccinated with Tdap, so they would be susceptible because they were not up to date. If the attack rate is 80%, then we would expect to see vaccinated cases. And, of course, we'd see some people that were unvaccinated or who had not recently been administered Tdap. And so of our cases, then, 27% would have been practically immediately vaccinated. And this doesn't take into account waning immunity. So over time, we would expect more and more people to potentially fall into that category. And this is a similar exercise with just DTaP. So some of the challenges we were faced with were the implementation barriers with some of the ACIP guidelines. We struggled with clinical recognition and diagnostic and reporting challenges, and we've talked about some of those already at this meeting. And we also struggled with what the most effective outbreak control strategies would be and who we needed to recommend prophylaxis to and whether we should use a very targeted approach or just blanket our community with vaccine and prophylaxis. But our primary goal was to prevent infant deaths and hospitalizations. And once we really established that that's what we were trying to do, it made making these decisions much easier. We knew that we were not going to stop transmission in the state of California. We wanted to prevent more infants from dying. So we really focused all of our intervention efforts on preventing infant cases. So we did put out state-specific CDPH Tdap guidelines in July of 2010. And in this, we recommended that all teens, adolescents and adults be administered Tdap who were under-immunized, even if they were 7 to 9 years of age. And if they were 10 years of age or older and had not received Tdap, we recommended that as well. And that included women of childbearing age, whether or not they were pregnant, and those who had close contact to young infants, and that included adults who were 65 years or older. And we recommended there should be no minimum interval concerns between TD and Tdap. We also recommended Tdap use among healthcare workers. In California, a new aerosol transmissible diseases standard was put into effect on September 1st of last year. And this is a requirement that all medical facilities and facilities that have employees who may be high risk for exposure, that they have to offer Tdap and MMR vaccine, varicella vaccine, and flu vaccine annually to all of their employees free of charge. And of course, the employees can refuse that if they don't want to receive the vaccine. But we knew that before this, a lot of facilities were not offering Tdap. We also were encouraging cocooning strategies. We know that a lot of our hospitals in California had not implemented a cocooning policy, and we were able to purchase vaccine through ERA funding to provide Tdap vaccine free of charge to facilities in order to establish a cocooning or a postpartum Tdap vaccination program. And we encourage use of TD or Tdap in place of TD for wound management in the emergency departments. And we worked with payers to help payers understand that Tdap was able to be reimbursed under Medicare Part D, which is something that we knew that there were barriers around. And working with other large payers who were not excited about reimbursing for Tdap for wound management. We also encouraged the use of the accelerated schedule so that DTAP could be given down to 6 weeks of age. And there's a lot of programmatic problems with recommending that with combination vaccines and then with just not working well with the well baby visits. But it was something that some providers were very concerned about and were anxious to implement in their communities. We put out a number of materials for providers. All of these are available on our website. If you would like to use them, you're more than welcome. And I'm going to point out this one in particular. This was a webinar that was put together, and Dr. Mark Sawyer is the physician that presents on it. And it's geared towards clinicians. And it's educational, it's well done, and you can download that and share that. And it's also posted. We had some materials for the public, and specifically targeting pregnant women. And then in terms of outbreak control, we tried to very much prioritize how prophylaxis was being used. And instead of just, you know, offering widespread prophylaxis to all household contacts, we really wanted to target just those that were high risk for having contact to young infants. So if there was a pregnant woman in her third trimester or somebody who worked or had contact with young infants, they were to be prioritized for antimicrobial prophylaxis and not just everybody. We also there haven't been good studies to evaluate whether community-wide vaccination efforts are effective in order to prevent pertussis outbreaks and transmission. One thing that played into our prophylaxis decision was that there is such a long infectious period and there is such a large reproduction number. It is really hard to use to identify which contacts are at most need for prophylaxis. We already discussed this. So we have sort of a natural experiment coming up this year that may help us determine whether or not community-wide vaccination efforts are effective. And it's starting in this school year, 2011-2012, middle school students starting in grade 7 through high school, so grade 7 through 12, will be required to have a single dose of pertussis-containing vaccine. So they'll be required to have Tdap. And this affects approximately 3 million children in California. And the current coverage estimates are around 53%, so there's a lot of kids that still need to be vaccinated. And the question is this going to have any impact on the larger community immunity and reduce transmission? And we do have some data from Canada suggesting that that could be the case. This is British Columbia. There was a Tdap policy that went into place for ninth graders in 2004. And coverage was very high. You can see the coverage rates here. And then this green line is showing the overall rate of pertussis among their community. And it has gone down and stayed low. And so it suggested that perhaps having a Tdap mandate could impact larger transmission for the community. So I wanted to thank all of the local health departments in California who have worked just as hard as we have at the state, if not harder, to investigate and implement the appropriate public health measures. And of course, our partners at CDC, who we have on speed dial and easy access, because we've been calling them constantly with questions, and they've been incredibly supportive.